You are listening to Natural Born Alchemist.
You're listening to episode 347 of the Natural Born Alchemist podcast. My name is Alex and I'll be your host. Before we start the episode, I want to entice you to check out my History of Alchemy series on YouTube. Just go to Natural Born Alchemist channel and you'll find it there. You can also search History of Alchemy on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, of course. In this episode, my guest is author, historian, and renegade archaeologist Dr. Heather Lynn. Her book, Baphomet Revealed, will take readers on a journey that weaves together the threads of history, symbolism, and esoteric philosophy, unraveling the tapestry of Baphomet's enduring mystique.
So thanks for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So you've been on before, but it was a while ago. So can you tell the listeners a bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, I am a historian. I'm an author, a professor, archaeologist, podcast host, a whole host of things.
So can you tell a bit about your latest book? Because it caught my interest. I actually had a few synchronicities regarding the topic. So when I saw you wrote a book, I wanted to talk to you.
So my upcoming book, I think you're referring to the Baphomet Revealed: Mysteries and Magic of the Sacred Icon. Well, that book, it's long overdue. I think you've heard a lot about Baphomet recently in the news. There's a lot of misconceptions about the icon. And I look at the icon itself in more of a historic sense. I try to go back and trace its origins and how it's looked at today. And I uncover some very surprising nuggets of truth. At least I was surprised. I wasn't sure what I'd find. Maybe I went into it a little biased as well, thinking that this was just a spooky sort of satanic symbol, maybe a little esoteric, but you know, I knew it had an association with the Knights Templar. But that was pretty much it. And so they say the best way to become an expert is to write a book. So I set out to do the research and see just why is Baphomet so iconic? Why is it so divisive? And is it actually an emblem of evil, as we're led to believe?
I think the evil part is where most people come across it. And it's the famous, for those who don't know, it's the famous man with the goat's head holding two fingers up and two fingers down. And I recently, you know, like I consider myself to not be either left or right politically. But when it comes to politically the right, what I agree, what they talk about is often they talk about, you know, stopping the deep state or stopping these people who try to have too much control or... And in those kinds of conversations, I often see memes with this Baphomet. They use this symbol and like claiming, you know, like the World Economic Forum is evil and this is their god. And so, and I think most people might have come across this image, at least in recent years, through that.
Yes, I do think so. And it has been on a lot of pop cultural material, things like t-shirts and even children's clothing I've seen recently, which is a little unusual, but it is a symbol that's been coming up used a lot more often. And so it was definitely something that caught my attention and it made what I discovered even more surprising. And so I'll just give, you know, some spoilers to the book, only because spoilers, you know, there's so much context needed anyway that it really doesn't spoil the book. But ultimately, one of the most surprising things I found was that the image that we're most familiar with about Baphomet, that iconic drawing of the being that's androgynous with the horns of a, you know, it has a goat head and horns and sitting in that position. It's usually a sketched drawing in black and white. That particular image was the only image of Baphomet that we really had, because the initial accounts of the name Baphomet go all the way back to the time of the Knights Templar. And it was not something that was described in terms of how it looked. It was just mentioned as something that the Templars might have been worshiping. And there's a lot of discussion about whether or not they were worshiping an animalistic deity. But one of the prevailing thoughts is that it was a misunderstanding of the word Muhammad. And so it was reported that over time, the Knights Templar, when they were spending time in the Near East, ended up converting secretly to Islam in such a way that they incorporated it into their mystic teachings. And so it wasn't even Islam as we would understand it today. It was more of an occult branch. And so they kind of developed their own thinking. And it was rumored that people heard them or overheard them praying to Muhammad. And the French accounts, the way that it was pronounced, said that they were praying to a deity called Mahomet. And so over time, that became Baphomet. And then you don't really hear much else about Baphomet for hundreds of years. And then later, this iconic figure that we see, that we associate with it, is an image that's drawn up by none other than a French Catholic priest who was a deeply faithful man known as Eliphas Levy. So what he did, and this is probably the most surprising thing I discovered, was that his intention for this illustration was not demonic in any way. It was actually supposed to be a representation of true Catholicism, what he referred to as true Catholicism. And that was this idea that eventually God's love would be so uniting that it would unite the dark forces with the light forces. It would unite all opposites. And so in the sense of duality, it would show that all things are possible under the love and forgiveness of God. And eventually everything would come into being as one in a harmonious fashion. And he made this icon thinking it would be something to meditate on, something that would be a very powerful image that people could gaze upon and look at and feel that love and unity. Which might sound funny now, because when you look at the image, it doesn't look very loving, you know, rainbows and puppy dogs and whatnot. It's a little spooky, but his intention was to make this symbol that would transcend the duality of good versus evil under the moniker of togetherness. And this was also during a time when he was doing this in the mid-1800s, where there was a huge fascination with socialism, Marxism, and other sort of thoughts in that direction. So this coming together. So this deeply influenced him, and he had some issues back and forth with the church. He differed with them on a lot of issues and felt that they were corrupt, and he started getting very political, and he saw socialism as a form of Catholicism. And this is, you know, he mixed these ideas up a little bit, and he referred to this as the, quote, true Catholicism, the idea of Catholicism being a unity of all things. And so in this unity, it naturally aligned with his view of socialism and communism. And so he left the church and took on this different name of a magician, Eliphas Levy, and was inspired to form this magical practice that would bring about the true Christian faith under the moniker of socialism. Now, you could see right here, as you mentioned, you know, about divisive politics and, you know, left wing, right wing, and this sort of thing, how it's already setting up to be something quite controversial. So Eliphas Levy went on to write a lot of books, but he really influenced thinkers at the time. So about in 1861, he started writing magical texts, and he influenced a lot of the up-and-coming bohemian-type philosophers. And even though his book was about magical rites, it became an actual bestseller. So it was a mainstream bestseller, and it influenced a lot of different thinkers over that time. And so you have that kind of in the background. But then it fades away a little bit, and this is what was referred to once as the occult revival. Much later, in the 1960s, you see what happens is a second cult, occult revival. And when this happens, people are also trying to rebel against these systems. They lean towards more left-wing ideas of socialism. and they start to rebel and they look at the past and they say, you know, these ideas resonate with me. And they adopt Baphomet as a symbol of this sort of anti-establishment, the coming together of both things, the unity and all of this. And it just so happened to be subversive and kind of scary. And so it was embraced as a symbol for, you know, musicians and artists. And, you know, it still made people afraid even then.
Yeah, and also somebody, if Levy was interested in socialism or communism in the 1800s, he might not have been interested in it 100 years later. So you can't judge. I mean, communism and socialism at that time, it was a different understanding than maybe like post-Soviet Union, when they could see what was going on there. It was still in its theory form, I guess you could say. But when I look at the image, because when people say it's satanic, there's a few things in the image that are clearly not, which is the double helix snakes and the Salva Coagula tattoos, which are like alchemical, and alchemy is not really in the satanic realm, unless you're a fundamentalist Christian. Maybe you think everything's satanic, but apart from that, it's not really in the evil area of history, if you know what I mean.
Correct. Yes. And so, because this symbol, when it was initially illustrated by this occult magician, he was very much interested in alchemy, and he incorporated these symbols, and he didn't have the intention of it being used for satanic purposes or anything of that nature. And he did have a different understanding of socialism, because in the beginning, when these ideas were coming about, they were very exciting and very new, and everybody was sort of putting their own spin on it. And his spin, he saw it through a religious perspective. And so his view of socialism was more unique to him and his vision of what Catholicism was. So understanding that and what he tried to do, it's quite fascinating that now that symbol's used to invoke fear in people, because it was originally a Christian symbol that was alchemical. And he didn't renounce his faith per se. He just basically left the church. He was kind of forced out because of these alternative beliefs and his rebellious nature. But he looked at Christianity as a different sort of alchemical process. And so if you look at the symbol of the Baphomet that he illustrated, you have the goat head, and that symbolized as the Sabbatic goat. It represented the duality of male and female, light and dark, and it embodied a universal balance of opposites, which is a concept often explored in the occult and in alchemy. The pentagram on the forehead, the upright five-pointed star, symbolizes spiritual supremacy over the four elements of matter and the physical world. And so he definitely knew what he was doing with regard to the alchemical processes here. This sign was a sign of enlightenment and a connection between divine wisdom and earthly understanding. And right above that, in the middle of the head, in between the two horns, you have a torch. And that is representing a flame or sort of a torch that stands for illumination and the eternal flame of wisdom. And that's usually a symbol of guidance and higher consciousness. And then, of course, when you move down, you see the striking image that, you know, makes people uncomfortable, which is this androgynous body. It's half male and half female. The body symbolizes the alchemical marriage. And that's the concept of the union of opposites, of course. And it serves as an emblem of spiritual wholeness and, again, a reconciliation of polarizing forces. And so some people, you know, once they get past the goat head part, which is, you know, frightening because it's usually in a pop culture associated with Satan, you see the androgynous body. And so there's that bit of nudity there of female breasts. And that usually makes people uncomfortable as well. And then you see the right hand raised. The right hand pointing up represents spiritual creation and the divine nature of humanity, which in esoteric thought is commonly used to denote spiritual authority and even apotheosis. And that's in contrast to his lowered left hand, the left hand pointing down represents the material aspects of life and anchoring the spirit into matter. And that symbolizes then the physical realities that we navigate as human beings. And then you notice that it has wings, and the wings symbolize the ability to transcend earthly material limitations. It also represents spiritual ascension, again, a nod to apotheosis and a quest for higher understanding. And in between its legs, you see poking up the caduceus. And as you mentioned, the symbol, it's pretty iconic and powerful. It's a symbol of intertwined forces. Again, it's signifying balance and associated commonly now with medicine. The caduceus held by Baphomet emphasizes the equilibrium and the healing power that happens when you combine the duality. And then when you go further down, you then are met with hooves again to reinforce that, animalistic aspect. And so that represents humanity's earthly connection to still both animal instincts and higher consciousness, and it bridges the earthly and spiritual realms. And then you did mention too, the Latin inscriptions on these arms, the one that's pointing up, salva, which is from Latin for to loosen or dissolve. So that represented the process of deconstructing matter and taking complex structures, reducing them to their essential elements, and sort of symbolizing the removal of the earthly constraints and, that alchemical process again, that's then juxtaposed to the hand pointing down with the Latin inscription coagula, from the Latin for to curdle or to clot, like where we think about, coagulation of blood. This inscription refers to the process of reconstructing those elements that were broken down in the process of salva. So again, that's just symbolizing that alchemical process, and then there's even symbols not on the actual icon, but within the photo or the illustration as well, like crescent moons that are both light and dark, symbolizing the duality of natural rhythms. And so the whole thing just reinforces this idea over and over again of transcendence. And, and if you look at it through one perspective of love and unity and all of this, it's beautiful. But if you also look at it and say, well, it's scary. What is it trying to say here? As you mentioned, there's a lot of political ramifications because we have the commentary on things like androgyny, things that people look at as, perhaps an occult agenda. And so unfortunately, depending on your perspective, some of these preconceived ideas about Baphomet, the more subversive components, they are often adopted by people who want to, stir up trouble, rather than focusing on maybe the positive aspects of the messaging. People like to look at it as a way to cause division. Because it's looked at as like an inside joke. Like some occultists know very well what this means, but if you don't know, and maybe you are coming from it using a biblical perspective per se, you might look at this and think, wow, this is scary. This is satanic. And then what happens is you're kind of giving that power over to the people who would use it against you. So that's one of the reasons I felt that it was important to write a book like this, looking at it as objectively as I could, just so that people can understand, hey, this is an image. This carries a lot of symbolism, but it's still nothing to be afraid of. You don't have to adopt it as your personal moniker, but you also shouldn't just jump to conclusions and be afraid, because often the people who are using it in these negative ways are doing it actually to antagonize, and then you give them the upper hand when you do that.
And also the two fingers pointing up, isn't that like the gesture you've seen Jesus paintings that Jesus or other saints do?
Yes. Yeah, you see that. And you even have that in the figure in George Washington, the first president of the United States, in the painting of the apotheosis of Washington. You see this in a lot of Masonic art. So it does have a bit of Masonry associated with it. There were some rumors a while back when Freemasonry was being attacked, more so than maybe in contemporary times, they were being accused of worshiping Baphomet. And there were even some pranks that were done and some hoaxes that were, put on into the public realm of Masonic worship of Baphomet. And so it's never been proven that the Masons were actually worshiping Baphomet, but it did become a big deal in about 1897 or so, when someone stepped out, a man named Marie-Joseph Gabriel, I believe it was, stepped out and declared that there was this story that was going around called Dr. Bastille's testimony. And under that testimony, it was an account of the Freemasons worshiping Baphomet. And it was an account that was pretty gory. And so it really scared people. But, individuals stepped forward and said this was a hoax. And but even though they had stepped forward and said it was a hoax, the damage was already done. So for a long time, people were pretty convinced that Masonic rites had an integration of Baphomet and this sort of thing. So
it's a bit ironic, because in Freemasonry, you can have any god as long as it can have the pseudonym of the great architect. So you can be of any religion, I guess. So it wouldn't be strange to have different gods if you're a Freemason.
Yes, if they did decide that, if somebody did decide that was their god, then that would be allowed under Freemasonry, but it wouldn't necessarily be endorsed, because as you said, they don't endorse one particular deity. They just have you recognize that there is one architect.
It also has the pentagram in the forehead, this symbol. And I think that also makes people think it's satanic, because they probably don't notice that it's not turned in the way when you draw a satanic pentagram. It's not drawn in that way, where it's two spikes up. This one is drawn with one of the points up only. So it's the positive version.
Yes, that's a very good catch, because a lot of people are not aware of that. They, like you said, they just see the pentagram and they think, oh, that's scary, that's demonic. But there is a difference between an upside down pentagram and an upward pointing pentagram. And the pentagram, as you noticed on Baphomet's forehead, is the upward pointing one that's associated with the spirit ruling over four elements. And it has a lot more to do with the positive aspects of enlightenment.
So is Aleister Crowley to blame for it being considered more evil? Because normies view Aleister Crowley's work as satanic, I guess you could say, because he liked this symbol.
Yes, Crowley did kind of ruin it for everybody as well. He did like the symbol. For Crowley, Baphomet was not just a misunderstood symbol, but instead he viewed it as a very potent force. He linked it to Satan himself. And so he really stepped out there before anybody else really did, because you're looking at, a brief period after Levy makes this illustration. And so from the original standpoint, it was a powerful symbol of unity and love and enlightenment. And then it wasn't too much longer when Crowley decides to assert that it is an image of Satan himself. And so, this is where we get some problems along the way with the symbol of Baphomet. It was very important to him. The symbol was deeply embedded in his system known as the Lemma. So he really did look at Baphomet as an inspiration. Now, the problem is there wasn't much to go on other than this drawing. And then of course some Templar accounts, but those are only accessible in some of the court recordings. So Crowley took a lot of liberties with how he presented Baphomet, and and who's to question Crowley, I guess, at that point. So it entered into the lore of Baphomet.
And now the modern Church of Satan has adopted it. I mean, didn't one of the churches build it as a statue somewhere, Oklahoma or Texas or somewhere? like a huge statue of Baphomet?
Yes, yes. The Church of Satan deliberately engages in what would be considered an act of symbolic reclamation. And so they think that what they can do is reclaim this figure for their own. Although, in fairness, you know, it was never illustrated or created with the intention of it being for that. And so the idea of reclaiming it is, you know, very subjective, but they do deliberately engage in acts of this reclamation and then using it to be divisive, to say the least. It's a symbol that's often met with fear, maybe fascination too, but even legal contention. And so it has appeared multiple times in public spaces and has triggered lawsuits centered on things like religious freedom. And so it's very important to the Church of Satan in that regard, because it's a legal symbol now. It's a way that they can put it out and assert their, make their voices known, make it feel that they have a legitimate claim to their faith. And, you know, and we can't, I don't know that anyone can judge that. If this is a church, it has an IRS tax exempt status, and they feel that they should have equality in how they are represented. And so often you'll see maybe a little town and they'll have a nativity scene out at the holidays and Christmas time. And then you'll see Baphomet maybe pop up, or, you know, some legal issue that way. But it is still looked at as an icon of rebellion, even in that usage. So it's very powerful, and it is doing the job.
But the image that we've been talking about and the cover of your book where people can see it, does it have any relation to the Knights Templar name Baphomet, or is that just a coincidence that he decided to call this image that name?
It does have the connection. It was originally unknown whether or not that name was a legitimate. It has a very murky history. Again, it could have been a misinterpretation or a mishearing of Muhammad. But either way, Baphomet was known to the Templars in some form or fashion. And then it goes dark for hundreds of years. Nobody hears about Baphomet after that. And so when Levi brings it back into the public sphere, he does so knowing that this was something that the Templars got in trouble for worshiping, so it was accused. So it did have an intentional link to the Templars, especially given that Levi was a Catholic himself, and he was very much interested in Catholic mysticism, and he saw the Templars as this like lost link between sort of Gnosticism. And what he was always looking for was this true Catholic faith. And he thought that the Templars had it, and that it was clear to him that they were onto something. Otherwise, the church wouldn't have, you know, killed them and put them in prison and tortured them and this sort of thing. So that to him was proof enough that Baphomet was powerful. And so it was intentional. He wanted to associate it with the Baphomet of the Templars.
Because when you read what the Templars were accused of, it's all the stuff that would not be allowed within Islam. So it seems strange that they would convert, that they secretly converted to Islam. Is it probably that that's just propaganda? That in fact it was more like maybe Gnostic, because in Gnosticism stuff like heresy and homosexuality seems more allowed.
Yeah, then that's an excellent point. And so this was something that, I mean, when you look at what they were charged with, it is not anything that would be, you know, halal. It's something that would be very much not a part of the Islamic faith. So there's things like the accusations of homosexuality or just indecency altogether when it came down to some charges that they were meant to kiss the rectum of somebody who was above them, their mentor, all kinds of things that would be pretty much lewd, things that would just not be condoned in any of those belief sets. So one of the charges, though, specifically was that the Templars had renounced Christ and even spat on the cross. And so part of how this was explained was that it was connected to not necessarily Islam as we understand it. Yes, maybe more of a Gnostic view of it, but particularly the views of who were called the Assassins. And they had a practice that was alleged of a concept in Shia Islam that is, it's called taqiyya, and it permits a person to deny their faith, to sin, or even just commit acts against their faith under duress or threat or persecution. So there is a loophole there that would suggest that even though these Templars were not acting in a way that would be considered pure, holy, or halal in any way, that they were doing so under some sort of fear of duress or in an effort to hide who they really were. And so it's hard to say, but this was one of the charges that that they were accused with, was that clearly what they were doing wouldn't fall under the banner of holy and pure behavior under any of these Abrahamic religions. So this was one of the reasons given, was perhaps what they were doing was taking this loophole so that they would be able to make sure that they didn't have to reveal that they had converted, or as it would be in Islam, reverted to their Islamic faith. So, but again, this is, it's so hard to piece together what actually happened. It is amazing though that there are court records and pretty lengthy documents that outline this, and those are the source materials I used for the book. So it does have a lot, but still, there's a lot of there's many gaps.
Well, Islam respects Jesus, and Christianity respects Jesus, of course. But so this spitting on the cross seems strange. But what it's not like of, I don't know so much about it, but there's like some sort of Orthodox branch of Judaism that does spit on Christ. I've read, I don't know, that maybe it was Judaism they converted to, I don't know.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I've not seen anything about that, but I think that would be an interesting avenue to wonder if there was some other influence that they had, perhaps. But, you know, even if it wasn't that they had converted, perhaps they did find something and they, you know, there were connections there with money and influence, and maybe there was some sort of, you know, there were definitely political factors at play. This is very clear. So there could have been things going on behind the scenes that were just not apparent. So most of this, I really do think, comes down to maybe less about the spiritual practices and more about following the money, because the Templars, they were very wealthy, very influential, very powerful. And so where you have that level of influence and power, and it's rebelling or competing against other elements of power, you're going to find corruption and sinister motives and all kinds of things that kind of lurk under the cover of a lot of excuses. Like, well, you know, they were heretics, therefore we had to kill them. It's, well, maybe, or maybe not. Maybe there was something grander to the story, and maybe it is linked to the gold and the treasures. Perhaps even, you know, we hear stories of the Ark of the Covenant, of the Holy Grail, and all of these different things, you know, that were hidden. And we know that the Templars have secret caves and passageways under the Dome of the Rock. And so who knows? There could be something there.
And now they want to sacrifice red heifers. It's almost...
Well, that's...
maybe it's the end times. Who knows?
I wonder about that too, because when you look at the translation, you know, it is a little different. I know red heifer, the color red has an interesting sort of history. If you know, for English speakers, there's animals that are considered red, but they're not necessarily red. So something like a red fox or a red-tailed hawk, those are usually orange in color, but they're referred to as red because of the color language. So there's this interesting phenomenon that happens with basic color hierarchy naming. And so some colors are named much later than others. So in this is very well documented, and I find it to be very fascinating. But usually as a culture matures, it identifies names color names like blue, brown, purple, pink, orange, and gray much later. It usually starts with black and white and moves on from there. So, and I kind of go into this a little bit in the book. It seems like a sidebar, but it has a relevancy. But this idea of the color red and how it's translated, you see this thing with the red heifer. But red is, you know, there are heifers that are maybe that brownish, like reddish, ruddy color. But in the Quran, it refers to the same thing, but it refers to it as a yellow heifer. And there is also discrepancy with how we would interpret the color red in both different languages and perspectives throughout the time and the evolution of how we would name color. So there is something there. So whether it's a actual red heifer, a yellow heifer, or what color heifer it is, I don't know if they're going to find the right one. But I think it's interesting that there's that discrepancy. I hope it's not found, because we don't need any more war, do we?
No, they have to build the new temple where they kill them, and they want to kill them where the Muslims have their sacred sites. So if they tear that down, then the whole Muslim world will go very angry, become very angry. So hopefully they don't sacrifice anything. But
hopefully not. I know that there was a plan to do so, but I think the local government stopped it.
It's still interesting that it's like not there's not so much time between 2,000 years ago and today in terms of these prophecies or rituals. That's kind of fascinating that it's still a hot topic.
It is fascinating because, you know, it's easy if we live in maybe a more Western or secular culture to just think, well, you know, religion, these ideas of sacrifice, these were what people did a long time ago. And so it's hard sometimes to wrap your mind around that this is still something that's very important to people, a lot of people, actually. And so we do live in a global environment, and those things have ramifications. And I think that's something we're seeing for sure now. I mean, it looks political, but religion and politics are intrinsically linked.
I have personally, I think that I believe in, I don't really know how to explain it, but I do believe that, you know, there's many different kinds of gods or entities throughout history. And that's why many religions had many different gods, like the Greek or the Norse mythologies and that. But these gods might not be real in the sense that they actually exist. It could be like a spiritual archetype of some sort, but it still exists on some level. And what I'm trying to say is I think this Baphomet is just another incarnation of the god Pan.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very great observation. I think you're right, really. I mean, I really wouldn't even have anything to add to that. I think when you think about archetypes, I mean, I look at it from that archetypal perspective, that these images and what they mean to people, they may take certain forms or change throughout time, but there is something consistent there. There's a spirit, there's an archetype, and certainly Pan fits the bill.
And Pan is a personal favorite of mine. I like his style, and he is very similar to the archetype of the Joker or Hermes and the trickster, and also like very connected to nature, but also connected to, you know, enjoying life and also having fun or being a bit mischievous. But I don't see him. Sometimes they see that archetype maybe as negative, but I don't. I just see it more like as a, you know, like yeah, it's like a, like in the tarot, like the fool. The fool is both. It's not really a negative card. It's also a positive card. It's taking life with stride. But I see the Pan in this Baphomet. I think is a good connection.
I think you're right. You know, they both have the obvious connection of having that goat type, or, you know, cloven hooves, this sort of natural appearance. And that's, you know, generally because of the nature of Pan being so familiar to those in the ancient world, very beloved too, because, you know, as you said, it was a figure of fun and frivolity and joy and freedom and all of these different things. And so Pan was very well loved. Over time, then these pagan deities become literally demonized. And so they become the images of the demons that people later think of. And so when you have to maybe draw Baphomet, if you're a Levi, and you think, okay, what's a demon? What's my image of a demon? You're probably going to think of that goat type figure because of the power of that demonization over those pagan gods of the past.
Yeah, and where I live in Scandinavia, also there's a creature called Faun, F-A-U-N. It's not really like what's the name of that famous book where you walk through a wardrobe. Narnia, you know, the Chronicles. In that book, there's a faun creature, and it looks kind of like Baphomet. It's like hoofs and horns, and then, but it's a man. It's not, doesn't have breasts, but it's very similar looking. But this character is in Scandinavia, is in folklore a character that walks around with a violin, it can hypnotize you with its playing, so you dance till you die if you're not careful. So it also has some sort of, like, you, most folklore has some sort of sinister twist to it. But what I wanted to say was that when I was a child, I had a very strange experience, because I lived right next to a forest. And one time I was looking out the window into the forest, and I saw this faun creature sitting on a stone with crossed legs. And it was when the very second I saw it, I closed my eyes and I looked away. And then I looked back and it was still there, and then it was gone. And this is the fact that I closed my eyes and looked away and looked back and saw it, and then it was gone. Made a very big impression of me, because if it had been gone quicker, then I could have just, you know, your brain can often project, especially as a child, you can see whatever you want to see. But because I looked away and looked back, ever since then, this Pan or faun creature has always been like, always felt like it was some sort of mischievous guardian angel in my life.
It's fascinating, this idea of the trickster entity and how they like to trick you and have, you know, lure you into situations. It's an archetype you see repeated a lot throughout many different times and cultures. And one of the more contemporary versions of that that we have is when people do particular hallucinogenic drugs like DMT or psilocybin, and they report encountering trickster entities that are sometimes called the machine elves or the clockwork elves. And they're often described as behaving and sometimes even looking very similar to these elfish or, you know, pan-like entities. And they like to laugh and joke and play music and lure you into deeper into the hallucination. So I sometimes wonder, you know, if what that means. You know, is that something that's just an epiphenomenon of the brain, or is this something that they're maybe tapping into, a collective unconscious of archetypes, or, you know?
It could be, this might be part of the cosmic joke that everything is a joke. Everything is serious. I mean, there are serious things, but it's also everything's funny, even though it's not, like, you, it's like a paradox. It's horrible that, like, thousands of children are dying in war, but in a cosmic perspective sense, it's also funny that we're so stupid that we allow it to happen. Like, if we distance ourselves from if we're like high above looking down and we don't have any part of the game and just look at it from a different perspective, it looks quite silly.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I know part of what goes on in the brain when you find something funny is that you feel uncomfortable or fearful because your expectancy bias was shattered. You know, this is sometimes why you'll often see with, say, teenage boys, for instance, if, you know, they're in trouble and the mom or dad is like telling them, hey, you need to clean your room. And then instead of standing there and taking the admonishment, they laugh, they chuckle. And it's like, what are you laughing at? It usually makes parents a little more angry. But it's just one of those things where they're not actually finding it funny. It's a stress response. And so we find that, you know, when you are stressed and you're having this level of angst and fear and anxiety, we laugh. And that's part of the reason why with, you know, comedians, they have to tell jokes that make you just slightly uncomfortable or surprise you in such a way that you are caught off guard because you were expecting one thing and it turns out to be another. And people find joy in that. They find, you know, revelry in that. And if you think of the word revelry, it gets it quite in the name, in the word, it says to reveal, it's revelatory. So it could make sense at that philosophical level that there is a cosmic joke because, you know, we're all in a state of unknowing and not knowing. And at some level, maybe there is that anxiety that's just in everything and everybody. And all we can do is laugh.
Yeah, that's why I've always liked this Joker character. And if you don't know, if you've seen the Christopher Nolan Batman films,
yes, I've seen.
So yeah. That the version they made of the Joker in that, if you ignore, like, because it's a Hollywood film and you have to have a plot, and if you ignore that he like kills people, and if you ignore that, if you just look at him as like how he is as an archetype, he's completely free. Like, he burns money, he doesn't care about laws, he does whatever he wants. And when Batman beats him up, he doesn't care, it hurts. It's like extremely empowering to be such a character. Like, you, nothing can touch you.
Yeah. Yeah, are you looking forward to the new one that's coming out?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I don't know much about what it will be. Oh, sorry. You mean Joker 2? The Joker. Yeah, I love the Joker films. That Joker is very different from the Nolan one. It's a completely different kind of Joker, I would say. And he hasn't really evolved yet, because the first film, he was kind of only the Joker for like a second. Then the film ended, so we don't really know what the Joker is yet. I would.
Yeah, the second one, it might show that a little bit more. And I really enjoyed the first one. I was surprised. I'm not really a big fan of like the superhero films, but this one was quite different. And I thought it was an excellent character study and a study on archetypes and the fragility of the mind, and deeply rooted in political commentary and this idea of, you know, what happens after nihilism. You know, the next step, some propose after nihilism is just absurdity. And so it's like, you have a choice to just give up, you're nihilistic. It's like, well, there's nothing to it. So what do? Well, you just laugh. It's because it's all absurd. It's all just a clown world.
Yeah, I loved it. I don't like those Marvel films or that, but I like it when it's a bit deeper. So I did like the Joker one, and I look forward to the new one. And there's a rumor it's going to be a musical. I don't know if that's true, but I don't mind it if it is.
I don't mind it either. That's the first one, you know, with Joaquin Phoenix dancing and performing like that. I found it to be quite entertaining, you know. So that juxtaposition again of the lighthearted nature of things, like dancing while the city's burning. It's you know, it was amazing. I thought it was a great film.
It's also a great like technique of how the people who made that film make you like root for the Joker when he kills that TV host. But really, when you think about it, that TV host hadn't really done anything, you know, like he was innocent, he was just like a bit of an asshole, but he hadn't really done anything, you know. not deserving being killed. But when you watch the film, you're like, yes, kill him.
Right? It is funny how you can, you know, have sympathy for somebody like that. But that, again, that's just, you know, the nature of those figures and great filmmaking as well. The second one may very well be a musical because it does have Lady Gaga in it. Yeah, she's going to be Harley Quinn.
And hopefully it will be a good one, because I don't think there's been a good one. I didn't like those Suicide Squad Harley Quinn.
Lady Gaga is a surprisingly good actress, and I think that she may bring a sense of seriousness to the role, at least enough to, you know, provide some meat as opposed to just having it about song and dance. So who knows? I have high hopes. I don't know why I have high hopes. And in fairness, I've been let down almost every single movie I've gone to lately. The last one I had high hopes for was Napoleon, and that one was just dreadful. I was so disappointed.
No, I think the first Joker was the last time I saw a film in the cinema that I thought was really good. I did enjoy Dune, but it's not as Joker is deeper, of course. But Dune I enjoyed more from a, just like watching a nice painting with nice music, you know. Are you working on another book now, or is this are you empty now of work?
I am working on another one. I actually just signed this past week on a brand new book. It is going to be, so I'm announcing it here first. It is a brand new book that is the follow-up to The Anunnaki Connection.
Can you talk about the original one so the people know what that is?
Sure. In The Anunnaki Connection, I kind of go over the Anunnaki. Very popular with people in the ancient aliens crowd and this sort of thing. What I do in the book, though, is I initially start out addressing all of those theories, and I take a look at and present the work of Sitchin and von Daniken and a lot of those ancient astronaut theorists, as they're called. And I present their work, but then I look at how that work's been perceived, maybe some of the flaws with it. And I just kind of point out that the theories that were first proposed about the Sumerian gods really happened at a popular level in the 1970s and weren't really updated since then. Even though in the scholarly world, there's been plenty of updates and a lot of translations done. But because I think people get so wrapped up in like a cult of personality and they're fans of these particular authors, they just stop there. So what I did was I tried to go back and, you know, give an update to what do we actually know about the Anunnaki. And some of the things I found, again, were surprising to me. I look more deeply into the question of what academics have dubbed the Sumerian problem, which is how is it that within the scope of only 200 years, where we went from semi-settled hunter-gatherers to having a full civilization with sciences and writing and inventions, and there's no explanation for it. The advancements were just almost a blink of an eye historically, and the individuals responsible for this so-called expansion into civilization and this agricultural revolution, their language came out of nowhere. It's not connected to any of the proto-languages at the time.
And isn't like the most logical one the Atlantis, in the sense that some civilization sank because they did come from the water, like, or they could have. I mean, considering how it's the Sumeria where it is, where there's like a wetland or the water shrinking back, or
And the Sumerian texts really support this idea that there was a cataclysm that displaced people. When you look back at their interpretation, their first account of the Noah's Ark story, it's very different than the Noah's Ark story that appears then later in the Hebrew texts. And the story that the Sumerians had really did point to this notion of a breakaway civilization. They said they gathered the animals of the steppe. They sort of put together a nomadic tribe of just their brightest scientists and agriculturalists and astronomers, and they went south and they had to leave the homeland. And when they got to where they were going, when they saw that they could plant and have agriculture, they also came across people that were smaller in stature and who they referred to as the black-headed ones. And they went about enslaving those individuals and forcing them to build the canals and build agriculture. And, you know, and it goes from there. Very interesting story, right from the Sumerians. The one thing I did find that made me have to kind of rethink a few things and then now write a second book was that even though it seems to be prevalent, this idea that the Anunnaki were actually human beings that were seen as gods by the semi-settled hunter-gatherer culture that was starting there, those individuals, the Anunnaki themselves, they brought their own sort of religious beliefs. They had their own gods, their own magical and occult practices, and they involve a lot of the things that we see shared among cultures and mystery religions today. And they referred to their particular gods as semi-biological beings that came out of the ocean, but they were also associated with the Pleiadian star system. They refer to them as the Seven Sages sometimes, and these were entities that they could commune with and speak with, and that would inform them on how to use technologies on Earth and in the material realm. And they protected those secrets. And so there is some sort of strange otherworldly connection with the Anunnaki, but sometimes the images that we see of the Assyrian art, the Sumerian art, most of the Mesopotamian art, people will just say, oh, there's an Anunnaki, but it's not. Those are very different entities. There's Anunnaki, there's these seven sages, and they're like the gods of the gods, if you think of it that way. And so there's a lot more to uncover.
So what would you say are those handbags you see in all these images? They're all carrying handbags. Have you seen that?
Yes, that's a very popular question and in image. They're sometimes referred to as the handbags of the gods. There's a lot of speculation about what this could be. You see online, there's some images of like astronauts and things that are holding boxes. And so people do try to make a leap to say it has to do with space travel and whatnot. But the one interesting thing that is true about this phenomenon is that you see it in not just Mesopotamian art, but you can see it all over different civilizations as well, even in Mesoamerican art. So there is something there. Now, in Mesopotamian art, the academic world refers to these as, say, buckets or purifiers. And it's been sort of known that what they were used for was to kind of, I don't know how you would say, act as an anchor, maybe, over something. They would be threaded and then used as an anchor. So that's one thing. So they may not have had anything in them altogether, but there are examples of them now that people have excavated. On my website, I have an article up that shows some of those images of these bags. So they weren't necessarily bags, but maybe they were, because maybe the artifacts that they found were sort of artistic replicas of actual bags. So it's hard to tell.
They look like very small handbags, like a woman would wear to a cocktail party, like those tiny bags. But I'm thinking like, men used high heels and makeup, and now that's only for women. But before, men did use that as well, or maybe even before women did. So maybe it is a handbag. Maybe like in the old days, men were like using handbags, you know?
I mean, it could have been something purely aesthetic, like an accessory. But right now, the running theory is that they were holding maybe ritual objects. So sort of like a medicine bag of somebody who could, you know, perform shamanistic practices or something like that. But again, there's really there's really no proof or evidence to show that, other than comparing it with different cultures that we see around the world and what they used similar bags for. So it does still remain a mystery. But what's interesting is you can look up in the archaeological record, not just depictions of the bags or beings holding the bags, but you can find some of the bags themselves made of different materials. There has been a suggestion that they could have been used to store meteorite fragments. That's something that's a mainstream publication actually posted that. put that out. So it's an ongoing mystery, not just in the alternative realm, but in the so-called mainstream.
For years, I've been working myself on a book about Joseph of Arimathea, the guy who gave his tomb to Jesus. My wife asks me a few questions sometimes, and I'm not thinking about asking them to you. Why are you spending so much time, as I do, like trying to investigate stuff that like happened thousands of years ago, rather than, you know, live in the moment and focus on what's going on now? This is what my wife says to me. So I'm not asking you.
Well, you know, I think that I think sometimes we need to ask new questions about old problems. I think that, you've probably heard the saying that history repeats itself. But I think that history rhymes. I think a lot of times we don't recognize that we're living in these cycles because we don't recognize it at all. We think that, you know, we're going to see things just how they were. And so we don't often recognize that we're living in these patterns. So I think that by looking at the past, it can give you great insight into what's going on now and what's probably going to go on in the future and maybe in perpetuity. And so not necessarily all the little surface details, but the underpinnings, the core ideas, we see those as cycles. And so it's almost like, I think, if you want to know about what's going on today, you could definitely look at current events and analyze it, but you really can't know what's going on today without knowing about what happened in the past. And not to mention, it's just really fun. I mean,
yeah, imagine writing a book about last year, how boring that would be.
It's pretty boring, right? And there's no mystery there to solve. And I think of Isaac Newton, you know, and he once said, no great discovery was ever made without a bold guess. And he's regarded as the father of modern science and the founder of the scientific revolution. But he was an occultist and wrote at length about alchemy and astrology and eschatology over his lifetime. Somebody could ask the same thing about him. Like, well, why would somebody like that focus on such nonsense and such, you know, irrelevant things or whatever? But it's like, you know, it informed what he did. I think these things, time is a construct, right? So if you're looking at the past, are you really looking at the past? Or are you looking at what's happening right now? I think it's all connected and we all have our niches and our interests and thankfully we're all different. And so, you know, thankfully there are people who want to read, write things and understand what happened last year. And there are even futurists who want to make predictions. And I think it's good that there's also those of us who want to look all the way back to figures like Joseph of Arimathea and the Sumerians and all of that. So,
yeah, cool. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to be on the podcast. Can you tell where people can find your books and your website and podcast and all that?
Yep, you can find everything you need at www.drheatherlin.com. It's Dr. Heatherlin, drheatherlin.com. And you'll see all my books and podcasts and everything there.
Cool. Well, thank you for taking the time.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
In a world veiled in mystery and driven by the quest for the impossible, join Alex on a transformative journey through the arcane art of transmutation. From ancient practices to the birth of modern science, we will uncover the secrets and stories of history's most enigmatic philosophers. The Natural Born Alchemist podcast presents a series that explores the trials, triumphs, and mystical pursuits of alchemy, the original quest for wisdom and power. Be sure to subscribe and unlock the vault of forgotten knowledge. Don't miss a single episode of this detailed telling of the history of alchemy, where we turn the leaden pages of history into podcast gold.
Check out drheatherlin.com. Now, I've not long ago played this song I'm going to end this episode with, but because of the topic in this episode, I want to play the same song again. And I actually listen to this song on a regular basis. It's a favorite song of mine. It's the Hymn of Pan by Aleister Crowley, Set to Music and by Brutal Wounds, and Read Out by Son of a Priest. It's a great, great rendition of this poem by Crowley. So listen to it, get empowered by it, and I'll see you soon. Freedom is in the mind.
Thrill with lissome lust of the light, O man, my man. Come, careering out of the night of Pan. Yo, Pan, yo, Pan, yo, Pan. Come over the sea, from Sicily and from Arcady, roaming as Bacchus with fauns and pards and nymphs and satyrs for thy guards. On a milk-white ass, come over the sea, to me, to me. Come with Apollo in bridal dress, shepherdess and pythoness. Come with Artemis, silken shod, and wash thy white thigh, beautiful god, in the moon of the woods, on the marble mount, the dimpled dawn of the amber fount. Dip the purple of passionate prayer in the crimson shrine, the scarlet snare, the soul that startles in eyes of blue, to watch thy wantonness weeping through the tangled grove, the gnarled bole of the living tree that is spirit and soul and body and brain. Come over the sea, yo Pan, yo Pan, devil or god, to me, to me, my man, my man. Come with trumpets sounding shrill over the hill. Come with drums low muttering from the spring. Come with flute and come with pipe. Am I not ripe? I who wait and writhe and wrestle with air that hath no boughs to nestle, my body weary of empty clasp, strong as a lion and sharp as an asp. Oh, come, oh, come, I am numb with the lonely lust of devildom. Thrust the sword through the galling fetter, all devourer, all begetter. Give me the sign of the open eye and the token erect of thorny thigh, and the word of madness and mystery. Oh, Pan, yo, Pan, yo, Pan, yo, Pan, 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 Pan. I am a man. Do as thou wilt, as a great god can. Oh, Pan, yo, Pan, yo, Pan, Pan, Pan. I am awake in the grip of the snake. The eagle slashes with beak and claw. The gods withdraw. The great beasts come. Yo, Pan, I am born to the death on the horn of the unicorn. I am Pan. Yo, Pan, yo, Pan, Pan, Pan. I am thy mate. I am thy man. Goat of thy flock, I am gold. I am God. Flesh to thy bone, flower to thy rod, with hooves of steel I race on the rocks, through solstice stubborn to equinox, and I rave, and I rape, and I rip.